You are now listening to the E-Watchmen Podcast with your host, Robert King.
Another edition of the Watchman's Post podcast. This program was recorded for the month of April in the year 2014. Actually, the first full week of April, a week before the memorial of the death of Jesus Christ. You know, this upcoming memorial, of course, will mark the first full moon beyond the spring equinox, which was how Nisan 14 was established. And supposedly it's the first of four blood moons over the next 2 years, which is a very rare phenomenon. A blood moon is when the full moon is accompanied by an eclipse, and the Earth stands between the sun and the moon, and some of the solar rays go around the atmosphere of the Earth and cast a red shadow upon the moon. I remember one such memorial night, maybe it had been 20 years ago or so. It was a blood moon. It's quite eerie to look up and see that. And so if it's not cloudy where you are, I'm not sure if it's visible in the southern hemisphere, but for sure in the northern hemisphere. But anyway, there's another hysteria going on. You know, remember the 2012 phenomenon, and you know, the world was ending, supposedly. I forget that fella's name, but he ended up dying after his... So he didn't have to live with the humiliation of another failed prediction. But and then it was Nibiru, and people were all hysterical about that. But now this pastor, evangelical pastor in the United States, John Hagee, has written a book about the blood moons and how it's could be a biblical sign of the time of the end, you know, because the Bible says, Revelation, Joel, Jesus himself said, the moon will turn to blood. Yeah. How would you disprove that? Well, consider the fact that in Revelation, with the opening of the sixth seal, it says that the sun became black as sackcloth of hair and the moon turned to blood. And the stars fell from heaven like figs from a ripened tree in a high wind. And every mountain and every island was rocked and moved from its place. So we're not talking about a natural phenomenon such as occurs with an eclipse, which has been going on since Jehovah established the laws for the sun and moon. Granted, it is rare, but we're not talking about literal occurrences. So can we expect with this blood moon coming up, the first one next week, that the stars are also going to fall from heaven? No, of course not. But, you know, it may be that if events start to unfold, that, of course, remember, one of the most significant features of the sign of Jesus' presence is that there will be many false prophets and false Christs. Jesus really emphasized and stressed that point, that the deception would be widespread. So it may be that this Hagee's theory of four blood moons, that something's going to happen, was the subtitle of his book, whatever. Of course, he's a big Zionist, and evangelicals are convinced that Israel, and nuclear-powered Israel in the Middle East, has something to do with Bible prophecy, which we all know that's a complete nonsense. But anyway, we are living in interesting times. And if you keep up with my updates, which I haven't updated lately in the last few days, and I have a reason for that, but the updates, I try to focus on the move toward world war, which will initiate the presence of Christ and the conclusion of the system of things. That's what I've been pointing forward to for some time. I remember back some years ago that I took a little bit of criticism because I have said that there would probably be a world war and that the United States was intent, the Anglo-American power was intent on encircling Russia and provoking war. And that seemed out of the question back not too long ago, but now it's quite a real thing, isn't it? Every day you read about some escalation of this standoff between NATO and the United States and on one side and Russia on the other trying to defend its territorial integrity. Anyway, I'd mentioned that I hadn't been keeping up with the updates. What was that Paul said that he was writing to one of the congregations and said that he had intended to come to them, but Satan cut across our path? I can relate to what he's saying. Satan has cut across my path. I won't go into detail, but family problems. My sister is in the hospital again, and I've been traveling 300 miles one way down to see her, and it's been rather distracting and stressing. I had to take care of her dog. She left her dog and carted off to the emergency room, so I didn't know what to do with him. I brought him home, and he's a red zoner for sure. He bit me a couple of years ago, and he's bitten a number of other people. He bit my wife Saturday. I had to take her to the emergency, and that's the last person he's ever going to bite because I'd done away with him the other day. Very sad affair, but I had no choice. I haven't told my sister yet, but anyway, if you're so inclined, you might remember me in your prayers, and I would appreciate that, and I know Jehovah would respond to prayers along those lines, so anyway, keep me in your prayer. I thank you for that. Now we go on with the show here. I have a number of questions, and excuse me. I'm not sure if I'll make it to a half hour again. I'm kind of pressed for time right now, but anyway, like I said, enough of the personal thing. Anyway, question number one. He writes, in Numbers, the 11th chapter, Jehovah tells Moses to gather 70 older men at the tent so that he may remove some of his spirit from Moses and place it on these men that they may assist Moses in carrying the burden of the sons of Israel. It happens, except that two men, Eldad and Medad, didn't show, but were on the list. But they still received the Spirit, and it was reported to Moses, along with a request for Moses to restrain them. But apparently, instead, Moses supported them. So here's his question. Does this foreshadow the anointed, such as yourself, that aren't at the tent of the organization? And does Mark, the 9th chapter, verse 38 and 39, point to the same situation, where a man is performing similar works, but was not accompanying Jesus and his apostles? If that is the case, then would it be reasonable to conclude that there would be supporters of Christ's brothers who are, quote, inactive, or for whatever reason are not part of the official congregation that would make up the great crowd? Well, that is an interesting question. And I do think your comparison to, from the situation in Moses' day with Eldad and Medad with what occurred in Jesus' day is quite similar. It seems that men have a tendency to, men who are dedicated to God and doing God's work, they have a tendency to dictate to God how to do his work. We saw that in this instance with Moses and the apostles telling Jesus, hey, this guy's not with us, make him stop. And we see it with the watchtower as well. You know, they have their organizational procedure and anything outside the guidelines. And in some ways, they're trying to tell Jehovah his business. For example, in regards to those who are anointed in recent years, as you may or may not know, newly anointed ones have started partaking, and the watchtower has called into question their authenticity or the reliability of their profession, professing to be anointed. And they wrote an article some time back. I think I alluded to it in an article. I've written one of the essays called as regards the first will be last and the last first. But anyway, the article said that it wouldn't make sense that at this late date that Jehovah would anoint a younger person who perhaps was new in the truth, that he would anoint an older person who has had more experience, you know, who had been a member of the other sheep, so-called, and he would select them rather than this new person who hadn't had this record of service before God. So in effect, they are saying this is how Jehovah works, and this is how, you know, whoever says they're anointed and they're not, you know, don't have all this experience and blah, 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 then they're probably not anointed. But what did Paul say about Jehovah's choosing, his calling? To the Corinthians, remember, he said, not many of you wise in a fleshly sense were called, not many rich were called, but Jehovah called the weak and the foolish things from the world in order to put the strong and the wise things to shame. Because a weak thing with God is stronger than men, and a foolish thing with God is wiser than men. So it's very unwise to tell Jehovah how he should do, you know, work his outpouring of his spirit. It's a foolish thing to do. But as regards the question here, he's asking, could it be possible for those outside the organization to be supporting one of Christ's brothers? Well, I appreciate the intent of the question. Perhaps the person, obviously, they're familiar with the watchtower's view of things and their interpretation of how it is that the sheep are rewarded, you recall in Matthew chapter 25, because they did good to Christ's brothers. Well, for a long time, Jehovah's Witnesses were under the notion that this has been going on for some time, the separating of the sheep and the goats, and Christ's brothers associated with the watchtower, and you do good to them by supporting the organization and preaching their message and so forth. Well, more recently, one of many regular revisions, the watchtower said, no, the sheep and the goats are not being separated at this present time. That will be in the future during the tribulation. Actually, the opening verse of that parable, Matthew 25:30, it says, when the Son of Man arrives and sits down on his glorious throne and all the angels with him, then he will separate people one from another like a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. So it's talking about the arrival of the Son of Man. He sits down on his throne, the kingdom coming. But they have this cockamamie idea that Jesus has two thrones, apparently. He sat down on one in 1914, but he's going to sit down on another one at tribulation and separate the sheep and the goats. It doesn't make any sense. But when the slave says it, you have to accept it, or there are consequences for not You know, you question the faithful slave, and then you're not supporting Jesus' brothers. Well, that's contradictory in itself, isn't it? Because obviously, if the sheep and the goats have not been separated yet, that means the basis for their separation has not come into the situation. In other words, Jesus' brothers have not been put into a position where people are judged as to whether they support them or not. I don't know if that makes sense, but Jesus' brothers are those at that time of his coming who are then punished, chastised, right? And they find themselves in the dire situation that Jesus listed. I mean, after all, how many brothers associated with the watchtower that would be considered, you know, brothers of Christ, how many of them are homeless, naked, hungry, or in prison? Some of them may be ill, but they're well taken care of in the Bethel infirmary. You can believe that. But when the holy place is desolated, the brothers of Christ are going to be on the street, right? And that's when people will be judged as to how they treat these brothers of Jesus Christ, especially at the point when they are sealed and accepted into the kingdom. They will be as though they are Jesus in the flesh, brothers of Jesus Christ, sons of God. And obviously that will occur after this revealing of the sons of God takes place. So whether you support me or the watchtower at this time, you're not really being judged from the standpoint of this parable of supporting the brothers of Christ. What we want to do now is have faith and obey Christ. And, you know, I've tried to encourage brothers and sisters not to leave the organization because it does give you a platform, freeness of speech to preach the good news. I know some of you try on the outside, but where do you direct people to if you're not, you know, supporting the watchtower in that respect? If someone wants to go to a congregation meeting or get baptized, what do you tell them? You know? So anyway, I don't offer any alternative, you know, otherwise I'm guilty of setting up a sect and accumulating followers for myself. And I don't think I would do anybody any service by recruiting little followers, you know. My intention has always been to announce Jehovah's judgments, right? And for some, that they can still function inside the watchtower, knowing that there is a future judgment of the house of God. Okay, I hope that answers that question. I think this is from the same questioner. He says, I'm fortunate to have a business where I can take the time to read from the Bible several times a day. It is incredible how much more I understand each time I reread it. There's still tons that I'm not sure about, though. When I look up prophecies that you reference from Isaiah that indicts the watchtower, it makes sense. Then I'll read the surrounding text, but I can't make heads or tails of much of it. Is its meaning hidden or waiting a time of revealing? And then he asks, do you understand most or all of it? Well, let's put it this way. I understand the big picture, I think. And I don't really, my mind doesn't focus on details, and I'm just not built that way, you know. I'm a big picture guy, so to speak. And I think once you have the primer, so to speak, to unlock prophecy, most things fall into place, the big things, right? So if we understand that the kingdom has not come yet, and all the prophecies that the watchtower is either attached to 1914 or judgments upon Christendom, if we reset them to the future and reset most of them from the denunciation the Watchtower has put on Christendom to the Watchtower itself. And I think that's the primer to understanding prophecy. And also matters concerning the last kingdom, the eighth king, the king of fierce countenance. When we understand that the final part of the days has not begun yet, the time of the end has not begun yet, the conclusion has not begun yet, we reset all that to the future and all the prophecies attached to that. That's really the foundation of understanding the prophecy. Do I understand all of it? No, of course not. And I don't think a lot of it has, you know, particularly Isaiah, it had, you know, an application centuries ago with Israel and with other nations. And it is written sort of in a primitive way using analogies familiar with, you know, the ancient setting. So I don't think you can, I don't think it's really intended to apply in little details in our day. Like I say, the big picture, though, Jehovah's judgments. I hope to get back writing on Isaiah. Like I say, I've had some distractions lately. And, you really need peace and quiet, as you may well understand, to read and meditate and to write. Anyway, I hope that answers your question. I commend you for reading the Bible. There's no substitute for that. And may Jehovah continue to bless your search for the truth, as I say. But of course, yeah, let me just add, there will be, obviously, when Jesus returns, he's the grand instructor, the great teacher, the grand counselor. Jehovah's the grand instructor, but he is the wonderful counselor. He will reveal all these things. That's what the revelation is all about, right? The unveiling. And open up. Remember, after Jesus was resurrected and his disciples were all in a quandary, and then he appeared to them, two disciples in particular, walking on the road, and it said he began to open up their minds to the scriptures. And that is a portent of what is to come. Presently, Jehovah's Witnesses, particularly the leadership, are blind and deaf to these prophecies, right? Who is as blind as the servant of Jehovah? Who is as deaf as the messenger that I send, right? Who is as blind as the one rewarded? So that there will be an unveiling and an opening of the minds of those whom Jesus considers to be faithful. Okay, another question here. Is the Watchtower's policy of shunning unrepentant sinners biblical? Please consider Matthew 18:15-17, and make particular note of verse 17, which says, "If he does not listen even to the congregation, let him be to you just as a man of the nations and as a tax collector." With that said, didn't Jesus eat and communicate with tax collectors? Matthew 9:10, to name one account. Well, yes, Jesus did communicate with tax collectors, and he also had some dealings with people of the nations, like, for example, the Phoenician woman whose daughter was demonized, and she asked him to expel the demon, and originally he said, well, it's not right to give the bread of the little children to the dogs, but she responded and said, yes, but they do eat the crumbs that fall off the table. And then Jesus healed her daughter. And anyway, you have to appreciate that Jesus was speaking to the Jews at the time. Now, in the scripture that the questioner quoted, he said, if he does not listen even to the congregation. Now, the point is, there was no congregation when Jesus spoke those words. The Christian congregation didn't come into existence until after Jesus was resurrected and ascended to heaven and, you know, poured out the Spirit on the 120, and that was the beginning of the Christian congregation. at the time that Jesus spoke this, the apostles and all of his disciples were still under the Jewish law, and they would be part of the synagogue, not a Christian congregation. So when Jesus was speaking to people that had their own prejudices and so forth, so for the Jews, I mean, the law separated them from men of the nations, and they wouldn't have a meal with them. And it took a lot for Jesus to break that barrier down. You recall Peter had the vision of the sheet descending from heaven, and he said, "Oh, Lord, I can't eat that." And you stop calling unclean what God has cleansed. But even years into the Christian era, Peter succumbed to fear of men, recall in Antioch, and he separated himself from the Gentile Christians when these prominent Jewish Christians came down from Jerusalem. So it was a really hard thing for them to separate. At any rate, Jesus was not saying to simply avoid men of the nations and tax collectors. He was saying, if they do not listen to you, or if you take along one or two others and they don't listen to them, then the third step in the process, you take it to matter to the congregation, and if they do not listen to the congregation, then let them be to you as a man of the nations and as a tax collector. That injunction wouldn't make much sense if it were applied strictly to the Jews, because all of them across the board would avoid having a meal with a man of the nations or a tax collector. So Jesus was just using that in an illustrative way for when the Christian congregation came into existence, and it was originally all Jews that became Christians. And Jesus is not talking about, you know, gross sins such as, you know, sexual immorality or, you know, drunkenness. Paul listed all the things that, you know, would debar a person from the kingdom and from the congregation as well. If a person practices these things, you put them outside the congregation. A little leaven ferments the whole lump. So I know there's a lot of hue and cry by ex-Jehovah's Witnesses and others about the unfairness of disfellowshipping and shunning, and it obviously causes divisions in families. But we don't want to go to the extreme of being lawless and saying it's not a scriptural provision or institution. It is. And so Jesus was speaking more about, in the instance in Matthew, when you go to a person, try to set them straight. He was talking about when someone sins against you personally, say a matter of slander or gossip, or maybe they borrowed money, they didn't pay it back, something of that nature. So then you go to them privately and try to sort it out. And if they listen to you, that's great. You've regained your brother. And then the two others would go to witness to the fact that you tried to straighten them out, and then ultimately the congregation. But yes, the Watchtower's policy is based upon the scripture. Does that mean that it's always just and fair? Oh, no. And that's why Jehovah will call everyone to account. But the basic premise of it is obviously scriptural. Okay, I have another series of questions here based upon a passage in Matthew, the 24th chapter. He said, in relation to the following passage of scripture, and he quotes, "Therefore, when you catch sight of the disgusting thing that causes desolation, as spoken about by Daniel the prophet, standing in a holy place, let the reader use discernment. Then let those in Judea begin fleeing to the mountains." So his first question on this, what is the disgusting thing? And his related question B, he said, what makes it disgusting? Well, as we know, the original disgusting thing was the Roman armies. And they came into Jerusalem and apparently planted their ensigns in in the temple area, and that was Jehovah's sacred temple. And, you know, the Romans respected that for the most part, and they let the Jews have their temple. But when the time came for Jehovah to overthrow it, then the Romans came in. And so that was a disgusting thing from the Jewish standpoint. And certainly it's disgusting from God's standpoint in the actual fulfillment. What makes it disgusting? Well, in the grander fulfillment, the disgusting thing is associated with the last king who elevates himself above every god and every kingdom and exalts himself. And it's basically Satan's imitation kingdom. So it's disgusting from God's standpoint that any man-made institution or effort could rival the kingdom of Jesus Christ. And that's what this disgusting thing will do. And it will stand in a holy place in that it will put Christ's congregation underfoot, trample it underfoot, smother it. And how does it cause desolation is the next question he asks here. Well, we need to go to Daniel, because isn't that what Jesus said? And when he spoke about the disgusting thing that causes desolation, as spoken by Daniel the prophet. Now, Daniel mentioned the wings of the disgusting thing in relation to the destruction of Jerusalem originally. But he also mentioned the disgusting thing that causes desolation in relation to the king of the north, that both the king of the north and king of the south set this thing up. But Daniel mentions it most prominently in the 8th chapter in connection with the king fierce in countenance. And Daniel was given this vision of the small horn that grew great, and it came toward the south and toward the east and toward the decoration. Remember, the king of the north comes into the land of decoration during the time of the end. And this prophecy in the 8th chapter is also earmarked for the time of the end. And Daniel was told it grew so great that it reached all the way to the army of the heavens, and it caused some of the army and some of the stars to fall to the earth, and it trampled them down. It exalted itself even against the prince of the army. And from him, it says from him, the constant feature was taken away, and the established place of his sanctuary was thrown down, and an army was given over together with the constant feature because of transgression. And it kept throwing truth to the earth, and it acted and had success. Now, pay attention to this 13th verse. He says, now I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to the one speaking, how long will a vision of the constant feature and of the transgression causing desolation continue to make both the holy place and the army things to trample on? So this is the exact terminology that Jesus used, the holy place being desolated, trampled on, the nations will trample on Jerusalem until the appointed times of the nations have ended. And the angel went on to explain what those appointed times were. So anyway, the society speaks very little about this prophecy in the 8th chapter of Daniel. They really gloss over it. And they say it was actually fulfilled during World War II. And it's so contradictory, for example, because they say that the appointed time for the nations to trample God's people ended in 1914. And yet this prophecy, which I just read, envisions God's people, Christians, being trampled upon. So if the time for the trampling ended in 1914, how could it possibly take place during the Second World War? You know, they say the holy place was brought into its right condition by, you know, some organizational refinements. It's just absurd. Supposedly, the King of Fierce Countenance was the Anglo-American Empire at the time, which they're not far off there, are they? But anyway, this desolation, the Prince of the Army is obviously Jesus, and his sanctuary is his congregation. The anointed, Paul said, have been called into the kingdom of the Son of his love, and their existence, their citizenship is in the heavens. So in that respect, they are the stars that are going to be thrown down to the earth. They're going to be oppressed. The constant feature, I believe that is the preaching work that the Watchtower sponsors. It is done as praise to Jehovah. Every time Jehovah's Witnesses meet and go out in service, don't they ask for Jehovah's guidance and protection and blessing upon their ministry? So that is going to come to an end, this King of Fierce Countenance, when he comes into this holy place, that's it. And that's what Jesus is talking about. What is the modern-day Judea? Well, that's Judea. Jerusalem was the center of worship, right? Just as the Watchtower is now for Jehovah's Witnesses. And Paul wrote in his letter to the Hebrews, before Jerusalem was destroyed, because the Jews were some of the so still attached to the law and the Jewish customs and traditions, Paul wrote this letter to the Hebrews explaining to them that that was all just a shadow. And he explained to them, we do not have here a city that continues. Right? They were still, some of them still very attached to the temple in Jerusalem. So he was preparing them to flee from that doomed system. He said it had become obsolete and was near to passing away. So that's the role the Watchtower has played. It is sort of like the Jewish system of things for Jehovah's Witnesses. We're under law through the Watchtower. And obviously many of Jehovah's Witnesses chafe at that. But it has, in a sense, served as a tutor. And when Christ comes, the Watchtower will also become obsolete. And it will be destroyed. But for those who stay attached to it, then that's they will be judged adversely for not having the faith to transition to the reality of Christ when he does come. And his final question here, what are the modern mountains? And that's a very good question, because Jesus said, flee to the mountains. Jehovah's kingdom is pictured as a mountain, right? Isaiah and Micah both have the similar prophecy. In the final part of the days, the mountain of the house of Jehovah will be lifted up above the mountains and the hills, and to it nations will stream. Now the Watchtower says, of course, that happened in 1914. That's when the kingdom was set up, and people that are now becoming baptized, dedicated witnesses are going up to the mountain of the house of Jehovah. But that just ain't so, as they say. The final part of the days has not begun. It begins, I feel like I'm repeating myself here a lot, but that scripture will be fulfilled when Christ calls his people out of the captive condition they will come into during the trampling. And that's when people will stream to the mountain of Jehovah, at the great crowd. So, very good questions. And I look forward to doing this again. My voice is going on me. It always does that around. I made it past a half hour, didn't I? Anyway, I've got to hit the road tomorrow, so I was hoping to do a program for the memorial. I don't know if that's going to happen, but anyway, I hope you are in a position to observe the Lord's memorial next week. And until our next program, May Jehovah continue to bless your search for the truth.